little flower can I get up if you don't mind? I said a little applause. I don't care for myself, but it sounds good on the tape. My name is Clancy Emerson again, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here this morning to discuss the following steps. We talked last night about the acceptances, the really non-debatable acceptances. We have trouble with drinking, trouble with sobriety, and somehow we got to come to believe there's a power here greater than us, whether we can see it or describe it at any given moment. Thirdly, that we're going to try to make a decision to turn our will and our life over to that power. And that's kind of a nebulous thing unless you can put it in the realm of, well, I'll do what my sponsor says, which is really the basic predicate when you're starting. But as you get along sober, longer you have to find more abstraction. It's very difficult. I think perhaps that one of the things that's difficult for people like me when I was new and occasionally now, because any problem I talk about I've had in the past, I occasionally have now. That's just how rotten I am. I hear people talk about how they've given up these feelings and just press the right button and they get them right back again. You know, some years ago there was a guy in our group, he's an old guy that couldn't convince us, and he's taking his second birthday cake. He looks like C. Aubrey Smith. I no longer hate anyone. It's wonderful that I'll find this freedom. That was just a posture. I've been listening to his diatribe for it. I said to the president, I don't know what devil made me do. I said, how about your brother-in-law, Al? He says, that son of a bitch. Every time you think you're free of all emotions, just wait a second. I think I mentioned this once a couple of times when I talked about the closest I ever came to being truly spiritual was at the International Convention in Miami Beach in 1970. It was a very thrilling convention. Bill Wilson was wheeled on the stage and gave his last talk. But again, I don't know why I'm getting off on this when I talk about the steps. It's just interesting little things to me. Bill Wilson, I'd heard him talk several times in international conventions. I'd met him. I sat in his office for an hour in 1963, and I knew him at least as a psychophant. And we came to the Miami Beach Convention. He was the scheduled speaker Friday night. And the guy said, he's too sick. He can't talk. And we were, oh, God. They put in some substitute. We thought, well, maybe we'll hear him Saturday. But he couldn't hear him Saturday. And I was staying with some friends, an old guy from Pittsburgh, and he'd been sober forever. And he said, listen, kid, Bill Wilson's going to talk. I said, I don't think so. He's pretty sick. Believe me, he's going to talk. I said, I don't think so. Everybody I could talk to people from the World Service Office, they didn't think so. Sunday morning, we're sitting on the speaker, going, and all of a sudden, the guy came in. Bill Wilson is here. He's going to make an appearance. They wheeled him out, this dying man. He got up, you heard the tape, he started off pretty good, he's full of oxygen, and all of a sudden, he ran out of oxygen, like this, slumped back in his chair, he had tubes in his nose, and they wheeled him away, and he died shortly thereafter. But I said to this old guy, this old fool, John, I said, John, how did you know that Bill was going to talk? Are you some sort of a mystic? Is that your thing? He said, no, I just happen to know that human beings are human beings. And Bill Wilson would never want it said that Dr. Bob talked while he was dying and Bill Wilson didn't. So we're dealing with people with human emotions. But so the point is, why are we with all our emotions, why are we going to go into these next things? And I find over the years, as I mentioned last night, I had a very difficulty with a higher power, because a higher power to me, if it were a God, was, if not vengeful, at least avenging. A God who did not really want well for me, but wanted to give me justice. And that's one of the things you learn as you get older in the world. This is when you're young, easy to say, justice! We want justice for the underprivileged. We want justice for all mankind. And especially justice for me. If you haven't got enough for them, give it to me. But as you get older, you realize, you really don't. The cry becomes, mercy! 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 I've had all the justice I can handle. So we try not to seek too much justice. But the problem I had with the higher power was that it's a difficulty, because what we're really seeking here, hopefully, is, I don't know what it is I'm seeking, but it's got to be something more than not drinking. I know how to do that. I went to the Texas Insane Asylum finally for, because I stayed sober too long once, and I finally wound up committing suicide. I was trying to help my wife through her pregnancy, and I stayed sober until I couldn't stand it. And one day they were all gone from the house, and I just pulled the car in the garage, turned the motor, and went to sleep. I couldn't stand it. So there's got to be something more than not drinking. After I was sober a little while, a few years, I remember talking to new people about why their belief in a higher power, how many have come to believe in a higher power. And somehow or other they got talking about how I had come, I'd never even thought about it, but how I had come to believe in a higher power. And which enabled me to continue to try to stay around AA. The big problem I had with the belief in a God, I suppose, was that God is a very selective thing. You hear that all the time at the podium. God was with me and wanted me to stay sober. How about all the people who are not staying sober? I guess that implies God does not want them to stay sober. In other words, it's as though you can stay sober, you too can't. You can. No. Yeah, you know. If that's the way God operates, I am not going to be one of the select, I have a feeling. You out. Or just a gesture. Those of you listening to this tape, I'm sure you missed that gesture. It was beautiful. Could hear somebody somewhere saying, I listened to all this crap, but the only good thing was the gesture, and I missed that. What is difficult to accept about God is that God, if rewards and punishes, I must be punished because I have not been a good man, and I've been evil, and I've been a sinner. And I finally, over the years, little by little, as I took actions and did these things little by little, I guess in retrospect, what I came to understand, had to accept, the most difficult premise in a higher power, is that if God exists, and if He is what people say He is, then He must be the same to everybody. We talk about in God, in AA, the grace of God. Is the grace of God a selective thing? Do some people get it and some don't? It's nothing I can depend on. What makes it unusual is that I think you come to believe that God's grace, hopefully you can accept, falls on everybody. Like the rain in Shakespeare falls on the just and the unjust. God's grace falls on everybody. But how can you accept that? Then why, when I go to work in the morning, with God's grace, am I stepping over the bodies of people who are dying, and they also have God's grace? How can that be? And the analogy, I guess, that came to me early in my sobriety that began to help me overcome this, was that it came to me little by little, I could conjecture it with a television transmitter. Television transmitter, on the day of the Grey Cup, sends out a picture, a clear, sharp picture of the game to every receiver in Canada. It's a sharp, clear picture and perfect. A lot of people don't even have their TVs turned on. Some of them have old TVs and they get funny pictures. Some of them don't even know there's a football game going on. Some of them who get the picture don't know how to dial it in. I began to equate God's grace with that TV picture. God's grace, or put it a different way, call it peace of mind, call it whatever you will, it implies that there's, God means good for me. He wants things to be good for me. He's not going to do them for me, but God means good for me. And he sends me forth a picture of good. But many, I didn't even know it's there. Now this television analogy, my TV set at home. I like to watch football games. And I have little grandsons who come racing through the room from time to time. They're always new ones, it seems like. And I can just turn my head and they'll have those knobs turned in no time. And I turn back, there are blue people going. Now the nice thing anybody learns has got any common sense is that you learn there are dials that you, I don't have to know how they work. I know horizontal hold, when the thing's going, that's vertical hold, I guess, that turns it and it stops it. Horizontal hold, anytime it pulls it back. When the faces are blue, you turn the tint. And little by little, the sound is funny, you get it back on. I don't have to know the theory of electrons racing through some kind of a tube in there, or microchip. You know, nonsense. I just have to turn the damn knob. But I can get a picture up to the... Now, I think that God is sending out this picture. Like, you're sending out the picture of that football game. And the picture is not of a great... It's called peace of mind, or grace, or inner harmony, whatever you want to call it. And it goes to everybody. And it doesn't care whether you got a Mitsubishi TV set, or a GE, or... Your picture of me have difficulty coming in, but the picture is there. Now, it seems to me, what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me, it has taught me to use certain dials to get that picture. The picture is there whether I get it or not. It taught me to use certain dials. Now, AA doesn't give me tools like a vertical hold that I can understand. That prayer, that knob is marked prayer. I don't understand if it works or not. I've been praying intensely, or to some degree of intensity, for over three decades. And I couldn't tell you today for sure that any prayer I've ever said got anywhere. I would like to think it did, but I don't know. There never was, the heavens didn't open and say, okay. But I know this, when I turn that knob, the picture gets a little clearer. That's why. Other knobs are not marked color, tints, horizontal hold. They're called love, or service, or doing something for someone you don't have to. Things that really don't seem to have any application. But they don't have to, I don't have to know why they work. When I do them, the picture gets clearer. But unfortunately, I'm a human being, and I'd rather just have the picture stay that way. Now, once you get a clear picture, which I've had a few times, a lot of times when I think about it, you think, now it should just stay like that. Now, what's the big deal? Somehow, it seems as though our TV sets are on the back of pickup trucks. Every time you get a picture, oh, shit. Incessant tuning. You just get tired of it. I'll learn to live with them like this. To hell with it, you know. I decline to get out of my easy chair to walk to that TV set one more time. That's too much. But I could accept that analogy. It satisfied me intellectually and emotionally that God's grace does fall on all of us. It is now incumbent upon me to take actions to bring that picture. And it's never going to be perfect and stay perfect. Because unfortunately, I am a fallible receiver. I have to be very careful sometimes that I do not base my life on direct messages from God. Because the messages are right, but my receiver's wrong. I remember when I was relatively new, God once upon a time told me to quit my job and punch the guy on the way out. Now sober almost 2 years. Well, I will be done, Father. Yeah. later on, upon reflection, I think the message was, do not quit your job and punch the guy in the web. But the receiver missed the do not. That's why it's always a little dangerous to operate on the basis of direct messages from God. That's why many times people who live on the basis of direct messages from God wind up in insane asylums. That's why we have to surround by doing things. But it seems to me, once we've come to a position in AA, where we've made the acceptance that something's wrong and I can't do anything about it, and there may be something here that can, now the next six steps that we deal with are all ways of clearing up some of the static. That's all. Just ways of clearing up the static of the transmission in the channels, to open up the channels, to get competing problems out of the way, to get the snow off, or at least as much snow off the screen as you can. And we cannot work on them individually. That's one of the great problems in Alcoholics Anonymous. We all like to say, I'd like to work on my guilt, or I'd like to work on my fear, or I'd like to work on my relationships. But it's very difficult to do that, because it all comes from a basic mishmash. It's like a ice cube container in the refrigerator, you know. There are some ice cube containers where they're made of plastic, and you can just make two ice cubes. So that's all I like to fill up. I like to work on those two ice cubes. But unfortunately, the one I have, and I suppose most of us, is the old metal kind, where you put in enough water for two ice cubes, you don't have two ice cubes. You just have a 1/16 of an inch all over the whole pan. There's no way to do this easily. So you have to work on everything, little by little. And it really is a drag. But once you begin to understand that, you'll realize you're not going to find big spiritual nirvanas no matter how hard you cram between now and 3 o'clock this afternoon. It's just going to be a long, endless process. And I think that's the fourth step is one that most of us would accept as a where you begin to take these actions. Up to then, it is the first three steps, I think, you must take again and again. And you take them every time you go to a meeting. You take them every time you listen to your sponsor. And you take them on and on. Because their intellect does not get you better. You have to alter emotional reactions and perceptions. And in my experience, I would never have anyone take an inventory early on in their sobriety because they don't have enough. That's what's wrong in many times of when people think they've taken their inventory in a treatment facility. I know they take the 12 steps and there's nothing wrong with that, but it certainly is not the end all of the 12 steps, because you can't take 12 steps, each 12 steps in 28 days or 28 weeks or 28 months or 28 years, really. Because there's always something going on, but if you take an inventory after 5 or 10 days of sobriety, you get one of two things. You either get an inventory that says, well, there's really nothing wrong with me. I drank too much and now I'm sober. And it's just fine, thanks. Or else you get an inventory that says, everything that's ever happened in the world is my fault. I was responsible for the flood. And both of them are equally inaccurate. That's what you get when you have no, you're operating on just reaction, alcoholic reaction, perception. And I think those are the two great underlying causative factors of alcoholism. I mean, in alcoholic emotions are pride and guilt. Pride is a compensation for feeling less than. I don't know very many alcoholics who really have pride, but they've developed a compensatory pride to disguise their feeling not enough. So you come to write a fourth step in AA, and you have to be sober a little while. You have to have enough security to admit how insecure you are. It's a funny thing. When you're insecure, you can't really admit you're totally insecure. You have to be somewhat secure. You have to have something to stand on while you discuss the flood that's swirling around you. And so you take the inventory. It has been said that this is where they separate the men from the boys. I suppose it is one of two steps. Bill, in the 12 and 12, describes the sixth step as the step that truly separates the men from the boys. And there's something to be said for that. But here, I would suppose in practicality, more people have balked at the fourth step than at any other step. That's where they stop. That's where they change. That's where it all begins to look different. And yet we must take this, even though it seems to have no immediate application, and seems to be a very painful thing to do. I want to work on individual things. I want to work on my relationship to my children. I want to work on how I can get along with the work. I don't want to work on just continually opening up things I've spent years to try to forget. But it goes back to that same old concept here. You cannot work on specific things very well when you are in a shambles. You must build a foundation somewhere. I was thinking of that analogy that I used to thought of years ago. In my backyard, there's a lemon tree. And sometimes it's a big lemon tree, and it gets very dry because we live in a desert. Sometimes that lemon tree needs watering badly. Based upon my perception of how to take care of things, I would watch a lemon shrivel a little bit, and I'd get my ladder and go up and give it a little water. And here's another one over here. Jesus, is there no end to this? Fall off the ladder and some boob comes along and says, why don't you just water the trunk? Because there's nothing wrong with the trunk. The trunk is fine. That baby up there. And that's the way I've handled problems all my life. There's nothing wrong with the trunk. It's just a series of stinking lemons. They're just making me crazy. So it has to be some subrogation of my own wisdom to begin to work on things gently. And writing an inventory is a rather strong beginning. And sometimes writing an inventory is a painful thing. I hear people sometimes surprised to say, I've taken the fourth step and it really didn't make me feel better. It's not supposed to make you feel better. It's supposed to make you feel worse. When you write down what a craphead you really are, that's not liable to make you elated. Oh, wonderful. I just discovered I'd like to twist baby chicken's neck. And there's people, Catholics, who say, I do that in the confessional. I don't need to do it. I told my sponsor, I don't need to do it. I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist for many thousands of dollars. Why should I take it with an out-of-work actor? Well, as usual, he got testy. He was always getting testy. Come to think about it, everybody I know always got testy. And I told him I wasn't going to take an inventory. And like most people, I was prevailed upon to take it. Not by my sponsor so much, but just by the day I was going to commit suicide. A little pain here and there. I remember that day, Rick, I'd been sober about 6 months, and somebody put in some clout for me and got me a job as a dishwasher. That gives you a feeling of confidence to know that you need intervention to get a job as a dishwasher. I tried to explain to him, I've been at the faculty of the University of Texas.
Just do the goddamn dishes. Shut up.
I did pretty well for a while, but after about 2 days, I've been very keen as to when I'm being used. I can see that. It became obvious to me little by little that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. So I began to deduce these little pukes are getting dishes from other restaurants to humiliate me because I'm an Anglo. So I didn't do a lot of them, I just put them aside, the ones that seemed to be overflow. And in the day I had quite a good selection in the manager's actually do the dishes. I said, no, let the damn busboy take them back when they're on it. those Mexican guys are really screwing you around. Well, turned out that I had miscounted. They were all our dishes, and he said, I'm going to have to let you go. I said, let me go? Then you have to go to the overdrive, you know. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not implied, not saying I didn't want to be, I just said I was, and I'm trying to find a new life, and I'm working 12 wonderful steps, and it's all this, you know, you do all the things. He said, I don't care about that, you just don't wash enough goddamn dishes. And he fired me, and I left. I thought about that many, many times since, I'll tell you. There's been a lot of times in my life, in much different milieus, I maybe have been up late at night, maybe helping somebody in the hospital at 2 in the morning. And it doesn't seem to me that I should have to go to work to be in that office, that advertising agency, at 9 the next morning, along with the same people who just went to bed or watched television, did nothing. I'm giving so much more. There should be some special treatment for me. And I hear that guy's voice. They don't care what your story is. We just want you to wash the dishes. They don't care at work whether I sit in the hospital or somebody come at 9 o'clock and do my job. We sometimes use AA as an excuse not to live in the world. AA is designed to help me live more comfortably in the world, not as a withdrawal from it. So how do you remember? When all else fails, I remember I'd want to do something. Just do your dishes. They just want you to do your dishes. Shut up. You can't really say it when people are looking, because it looks funny when you just say, shut up, shut up. Sometimes you just have to do with mind. But that day I decided, I've been sober 6 months, I couldn't hold a job as a dishwasher, I decided to kill myself. And I started to, and I didn't want to, I never been into pain much. I had no car to drive, to put on the, take carbon monoxide, which isn't a bad way to go, I might say. But so I decided to walk in the ocean, because I'd always been rather dramatic. And I was setting my mind that a star is born, Frederick March, walking in the ocean. And they're all sorry later to me. But we lived, poor Norman, Maine. And so I started to walk to the ocean, and see, I hadn't been there walking, and I walked and walked, and that's a big town. I was in Beverly, eastern end of Beverly Hills, and I walked and walked and walked, and I couldn't find the ocean. I was walking that dramatic, maybe you've done this, if you're depressive, sometimes you walk through the streets when you're really depressed, and you just know that you're like Hamlet walking the battlements of Elsinore. It's just, you're a tragic figure, and people must be looking at you saying, ooh, what a tragic and wonderful figure. What a terrible load he must carry. It really doesn't strike you what you're saying. Did you see that asshole? But you walk, and I walked. I couldn't find the ocean. I finally stopped at the gas station. I said, where's the ocean? Here's the western end of Beverly Hills. You have to walk past the Veterans Hospital and then another 3 miles. I said, well, I don't mind dying, but I'm not going to walk 5 miles. So I called I realized I'd walked into my foster's fare zone, cold zone. It only cost 10 cents from there, so I decided to give him a call. I hated to call him because he didn't like bad news. I discovered that over the years. Made him testy. But I called him. I said, I'm just going to, what I'll do, I'll try to touch his heart. I'll tell him, I used to be a good writer once upon a time. Well, I'll tell him a story that'll be so sad, even his heart will ring. He'll say, I'll come and be at your side, son. Hello, this is Clancy Bell. Why don't you work? Just a minute, Bob. I said, you know, there's something you don't really realize. I lost my kids and my family and my home. And my parents have ripped me off. I'll probably never work in my field again. And I know that, Bob, but that isn't what I want to talk to you about. There's something you don't know about. You know, even inside of AA, Bob, there's something different about me. And I've been here 6 months. I've been going to meetings every night. But even here, people treat me different. They realize there's something different about me. I'm not. And they go to parties, and I think they don't tell me. They go off by themselves. After meetings, they go and have coffee. If I stumble onto him, they say, sit down, but begrudgingly, but they don't invite me. When I sit down in the club, talk to someone, they find any reason to get up and go to a different table. I never get called on to participate. I get called on once, I tell them how I feel, and I never get called on again. Bob, there's something terribly wrong with this. AA doesn't seem to be accepting me. And it suddenly struck me, this is true. The worst story I could think of was mine. And I don't know about others, but it touched me so much I burst into tears. I said, Bob, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And I figured, yeah, you know, my sponge said,
why'd you write your goddamn inventory the way I told you?
And I just explained to him why I did it. I said, in my judgment, Bob, writing it, I've told you this before, writing an inventory doesn't help people like me. I'm already consumed with guilt and despair, writing and digging up myself can't help, Bob, in my judgment. That's the last thing in the world, I think.
In your judgment? Who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car. If I wanted your judgment, I'd come out and put my head in the back window and ask you for it. Well, I've been living in a big house in Pacific Palisades. Who cares how it looks to you? I'll tell you. My sponsor was rather peremptory, I'm sorry to say. He did not know much about sponsorship. Several times I thought in that first year, that was one of the times right there, if I had the money, I would call up the World Service Office in New York and have this man stopped. I could just visualize myself. I just want you to know there's an old timer in Los Angeles killing newcomers. And I'll give you his name, address, and phone number. I never had the money to do it, unfortunately. Now it's many years later, it's 37 years later. When I talk to the World Service Office, it's all different. I say, no, I'm not. I've been on both sides of this equation, and I'd rather be on this side. I'd rather be the one sleeping and let somebody else lay awake and think about me. Someday I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him someday. But that day he made me so upset that in a fit of absolute craziness, I came out of that telephone booth. Thank God I turned left. I turned right and I made the ocean in two bounds. I got to go, give me the paper. I'm letting my finger go. I was just crazy. I wrote things that I would never tell anybody. In fact, what my sponsor told me the week before, he says, if you ever write an inventory, put in things you don't tell your psychiatrist. Put in everything. And I told my psychiatrist everything. And after I wrote, I hadn't told my psychiatrist anything. Right? You think I'm going to spend that much money to tell a guy something that's going to make him reject me? Get out of my office, you sick son of a bitch. I told him what he needed to know. Unfortunately, he couldn't do it. He didn't have enough ability to handle it. But I wrote this inventory, things in which I wasn't the hero at all. Oh, God, hideous things. Terrible things. I got all done with that. Boy, I had a little terrible feeling when I realized what a filthy thing I was. But I had a little feeling of relief, too. Because I'd written this inventory, and despite what that old fool said, it didn't make me all feel that all much better. I proved writing an inventory didn't work, and that cheered me up. I didn't have what you call a good attitude. About a week later, I'd stayed in this depression for a week, and I was about to commit suicide again, and I said, I guess I'd better read it to the old fool. Can I read you this inventory? All right, my time. So he took me in his car. We rode along the ocean for 40 miles to Oxnard. And he gave me a flashlight and a piece of paper. And I read this
It was a little easier moving in the dark, I'll tell you that, than sitting looking at him, which he knew. And I read this, and I did the same, I'm sure, because I've heard it my time since. Same thing. You know, it's a good inventory when they start off by saying, now, before I read this part, let me explain it. Never mind explaining, just read it. And you read, maybe a little tear dropped. And we got up near Oscar, and I thought, he's going to make me get out of his car. Right? I didn't realize how rotten it was until I got almost done with it. I looked over, and he's going, oh. I pushed him over the edge. We made him go to a crash. That's the funny thing. Since then, I've taken that ride maybe 200 times on the other side, driving. While some other little puke has been over there with a flash. Now, let me explain this. And I've always been a much better listener than my sponsor was. I always turn my head when I yawn. There's only so many things you can do with your mind and body. And for years I've wished, God, I hope you'll have something good in that inventory, something new, just something to break up the hideous monotony. And they never do. I don't tell them that, but I wish it, you know. There's something new. After a while, you just get to see your patterns, because they're all, humans are remarkably the same, down at that level, alcoholics are, you know. You almost tell. You tell me they left something, didn't you leave something out there? You were talking to that bitch? No? But that is usually followed by that. And on and on. But I wrote an inventory, my sponsor shared his weaknesses with me, much to my surprise. And as a result of that, I felt better. And I, later on, looking in the book, discovered it in the big book, Bill Wilson talks about, once you have taken this step, if you have left nothing out, you find a walk on a big highway with God, hand in hand. This morning, I was glancing, chapter 5, in the step 5, in the 12 and 12, he writes a good description of this feeling. Provided you hold back nothing, your sense of relief will mount from minute to minute. The dammed up emotions of yours break out from their confinement and miraculously vanish as soon as they are exposed. As the pain subsides, a healing tranquility takes its place. And when humility and serenity are so combined, something else of great moment is bound to occur. Many an AA, once agnostic or atheist, tells us that it was during this stage of Step 5, that he actually felt the presence of God. And I believe that to be literally true, because there's been so much jammed up and dammed up. And you know that of yourself, as long as it stays within you, it is completely out of perspective. I think that's the secret of all of AA. Every time you talk about something, every time you write about something, it is never so horrible, because once it gets outside of you, it becomes a finite thing. I'm sure most of you have the experience of where you just tell somebody that's just something just making you crazy, and shortly thereafter, it was just another thing. Small, finite thing with finite answers. But the fourth and fifth step is an easy step to understand how it works after you have done it. But before you do it, it is always very difficult, because we can all always say, well, it wasn't anything. But to every individual, it means this. I must expose things that I am not confident there's anyone else like me. And you say, how do I write an inventory? What do I put down? Big thing, the mechanics of, we don't pay much attention, but the mechanics of writing an inventory. Now, the big book has this thing on fear, resentment, written in 1938, and we've become, well, I'm not putting that down, but we become much more sophisticated since then. We understand there's a lot more that we have to deal with in fear and resentment. And the tendency sometimes to put down long, just a hideous 88 pages of self-obsessed biography, autobiography. Some people just write a few sentences on and on. And it's very difficult. One of the things, since I've listened to a lot of inventories and I have sponsored a lot of people over the years, which incidentally, talk about step 12, but sponsorship to me is the most valuable single tool in all of AA. primarily because when I'm thinking about that sick puke, I'm not thinking about this sick puke. That's like a paid vacation in the country, yes. But I have, over the years, I'm not certainly superimposing myself over any authority in the field, but for my purposes, I've devised seven questions that I give to people that I believe when they answer it thoroughly will have written a good inventory as I understand it. And the question, I mean, there's all sorts of ways to do this. I mean, Hazelden puts out a book that you cannot finish if you live with two lives, you know. Just and there are some people who seem to be rather prurient. Their whole outline on fifth step is sex. It's just as though, tell me some more about that. Call me up at home. Yeah. Hey. It's somewhere not quite like that. It is a big step, but it is only one or fourth and fifth step, or just one step and another step. That's all. No more and no less important than the others, but they do have an integral part. Because we've agreed now to change, try to follow AA's ways. Now we have to identify what the hell we have to work on. And that's all it is. To get up some of the crap that we've hidden all our lives. And most of us know that. And the questions I have devised, which I give to people, and seem to work well, and I'm certainly not recommending them to anybody else, but one, in looking back over your life, what memories are still painful, are still guilt-ridden, are still dirty? Sometimes the answer to that one goes for 20 pages, sometimes for one page. Two, in what ways do you today feel inadequate as a person? Three, who do you resent and why? Be as specific and nasty as you can. Four, what do you conceive to be the ongoing problems in your human relationships? What seems to carry through in your human... So everywhere you go, there always seems to be the same kind of reaction. Five, what do you consider to be your defects of character as you see them? Six, what would you say today is your goal in life, whether realistic or not? Seven, how do you think AA can in any way possibly help you to start towards any of these goals? Now, it doesn't sound very complex, but people write long answers to those questions and they start writing, because the biggest problem is to really get the pencil on the paper. Once you start writing, it gets a little easier. It's getting that pencil on the paper to have something to write. Oh yes, I understand that. Well, I'm guilty. Blah, blah, blah. And as they write, it starts to come out. I think one of the ways you know they've written a good inventory is when they're reading it, they start to cry at the enormity of it. They're not even cry, you know, but just to choke up a little bit. It gives me a divine thrill when someone's reading their inventory and they choke up because they've written something they have buried so long they can't imagine they're reading it. And, as a result of that, of course, they have a chance to write. And there's nothing really very new. There are new specifics, but not new underlying problems. Because it's always been my concept of this theory that the underlying problems are really the same. The things that underlie, seems to me, every fifth step I've heard, always gets back to those two main things. Lack, feeling less than, accompanied by false pride, together with guilt. And these things make us take actions that we would not ordinarily take. We have to defend, we have to prove, we have to overcompensate, we have to take these actions. And little by little, we live in just a tangled web. Is not going to change the fact that you were in jail while your son died. I remember that's one of the things I could not bear to look at. I put it in my inventory. I swore I'd never tell it to this soul. So it's just so hideous to me. and I've mentioned thousands of talks since. I've talked to people who lost their children. Now, there's nothing in my inventory that's going to make me, or what my sponsor says, going to undo that. My son's grave is going to be there, and I'll have been in jail and feel as though I caused this. That's how I felt. Because the result of the inventory, I began to realize I did not cause this death. It's a natural phenomenon. It's a fact of existence. But there are ways it need never happen again. And that then and now is now. And sometimes I think one of the great things about AA, it makes me look back at many of the things I've done, almost as though they were done by a mentally retarded brother. Someone who's doing the best, really, someone who was really doing the best he could but had no tools to do it. Just stumbled and went from crisis to tragedy to crisis to tragedy and never understood why. Just no cause and effect in any way. And I think that's the great value of the fourth and fifth step. You begin to realize that these are not singularly evil things you've done. They're natural results of people who stumble and don't know what they're doing. I believe that at any given moment in life, everybody thinks they're doing as best they can. I've always believed that. That's what makes problems in international relationships. You know, we keep saying, well, we're fighting Hitler, good against bad. But Hitler feels he's fighting the United States, good against bad. Everybody feels they're right. People always feel they're right. They can justify why I'm right and you are wrong. They talk about the terrible pogroms and the terrible Holocaust in Europe, millions of Jewish people. How can anybody assume that's right? Because the Jewish people have for centuries ruined our country. We must rid ourselves of them, and if they won't leave voluntarily, they must be exterminated for the good of the world. Everybody feels they're right. I mean, the great battles of the medieval times, armies fighting both of them to convince the other one, my approach to love and God is better than your approach to love and God. Great armies wheeling and marching around through Central Europe and the Crusades. So it isn't a matter of feeling that you're right. It's trying to find a better knowledge of how to go about things. And in the fourth and fifth step, I have made truly the first major surrender of my sobriety. I've surrendered. I've said, yes, I drink too much, and I'm sober too much, and I can't stay sober, and I don't like drinking, and life is terrible, and maybe there's a power here, and I'm going to try to surrender. But I've actually operated on that power. And I think you must have some security to do this, because no one is going to expose themselves like that if they have, without having some hope that there's a reason for it, because I can't see the reason. In other words, voluntarily, I must do something that I spent my life trying to not do. I must open my armor and make myself vulnerable. Now, one of the little mechanics in AA is that who do you take this fifth step with? Now, where I live, it is rather common, I don't know if it's good or bad, but shake with your sponsor. And people say, what if your sponsor gets drunk and talks about you? I don't think anybody cares about you. Your fifth step isn't all that wonderful, really, but I can remember a lot of things people did, I just can't remember who did them, you know. If I could, I'd be a rich man today. It really is rather extraneous. In the book it says maybe you want to go to a clergyman or a complete stranger. I would much rather take my chances with my sponsor than a complete stranger. But I don't know what he's going to do with it at all. Oh, you say you're with a star on the globe? Oh. But it's kind of an interesting thing. I'm willing to trust my sponsor with the direction to save my life, but I don't want him to know what's wrong with me. I'm going to impress him. I have to keep telling people, all right, stop trying to impress me. Sponsors automatically know you're a fool. That's the one person who does. You have to impress him. He knows you're a fool. We can work from there. Oh, yeah, I guess I'm trying to impress your sponsors. The way you impress your sponsor is taking actions and doing things whether you want to or not. I remember when I was about a few years sober, my sponsor died, and I got this other sponsor, this spiritual giant, whom I hated,
But he was the most active man that I ever knew in the world, and the most dedicated, so he asked me to be my sponsor. And I couldn't, he didn't want to discuss much of anything with me, really. He just wanted to know what I was doing. And I, year after year, took actions and did things to win his approval. God, I worked hard to do it, then I did it. But it was that did more for me than all the abstract information in the world. Just watching him smile and say, you've done a good job. Oh, hell, anyone could have done it. It has a reverse side, though. Sometimes, he'd be tired. He came home from work. And, gee, it's Friday night. And I'm home with my family. I'm 10 years sober. I'm working in big advertising. I've got a lot of pressure. It's Friday night. I see my calendar. Let's go speak in Oakdale, which is 90 miles north. And the freeway is jammed. It's a hot summer night. And there's about 20 people in the meeting. And they just are like wax figures. And, and it's just hideous. I'd rather sit home and talk to a painting, you know. And I called my sponsor. Chuck, I said, don't misunderstand me. I'm very grateful for what he's done for me, but geez, you know, I'm out all the time. And it's tonight's Friday night, and my some of my kids want to go to the show, and Oakdale Affairs, 90 miles, and it's just too hot, and the traffic's too bad going out of town. Can I, wouldn't you think it'd be all right to call him and say, get another speaker close by? He said, well, son, I tell you what, I can't talk to you right now. I have to leave early because I have to go to Lake Arrowhead, which is 110 miles away. And talk to those 8 people up there, but if you'll call me in the morning, we'll talk about it. That's the day you feel like saying, I think he's about served his purpose as my sponsor. And the great criticism of Chuck C. is he does too much. He pushes himself too hard. But he always felt better than the people who were criticizing him. There's a moral there somewhere, but I can't make out what it is. Almost as though action is the magic word. But anyway, fourth and fifth step, quite obviously is a great turning spot. And I think that since I'm allowed to change the format any way I want to, I think we ought to stop now for 15 minutes and have a cup of coffee. All right.